Hello, welcome to Unfortunately Required Reading. Tori has told me that she's trying to grow murder plants.
They're really pretty.
They okay. are really pretty.
I'm trying to learn how to grow belladonna. It is evidently incredibly fickle. Mm-hmm. See, I'm like finally got plants to grow, and so now I'm like, look at me, lady of the spring, which is hilarious because I kill everything. But when you have something that like circulates water around it constantly and like mm-hmm. mimics the sun, and it's not the Texas heat killing everything, it works.
Yeah.
So I'm going to try that. It probably won't grow, but it'll still make me feel like a badass for about 2 weeks while I think I can sprout them.
It is August and we are back. Tori, what are we reading?
We are reading Sadako and the Thousand Paper Cranes, which we went for a kid's book once. But it is a really heavy topic for a kid's book.
This is a dour and sad kid's book. Like, you know, again, premise of the show is, you know, why do we make kids read this stuff? I get why, but we're not going to jump the gun. Sadako and the Thousand Paper Cranes. We sure do know how to pick them, don't we?
Yeah.
But it felt appropriate because,
I'm sorry, go ahead.
Well, no, especially after, like, all of the Oppenheimer stuff, it just felt really appropriate because we talked about this last month that, like, some people have been watching Oppenheimer and seem to be getting the wrong point. That the bomb is not the hero of the movie.
Yeah, real bad. Real bad situation. There's a reason our parents' generation is terrified of nuclear war, and so are we.
Yeah, that's such a weird thing for me when it comes to history, is that, like, the minute you put any distance behind something, it, like, immediately becomes toothless. And, like, that's a very recent phenomenon that, like, we, in this particular historical epoch that we're in, we think that we are so far removed from history when, like, we're not. Like, the AIDS crisis was not that long ago. Like, civil rights in America was not that long ago. Like, integration of schools was not that long ago. Roe v. Wade was not that long ago. But, like, we feel like we're super far away and super far removed from this stuff. That, like, there are people that survived that bombing Hiroshima and Nagasaki that are still alive and are still talking, and it's like, what do you mean? Like, that feels like it shouldn't be a thing, but it's a thing. So yeah,
and we'll put some of the videos of, like, people talking about it in the
so, because they can talk about it much better than we ever can, because we're going to talk about atomic anxiety, especially from the American perspective, because I think Tori and I are just old enough to where we both still have a little bit of it.
Oh, yeah. No, I'm still... When I found out that we have, technically still have bomb shelters in San Antonio, I was like, we would never reach them in time.
My alma mater has several shelters. We're good. So...
Head to St. Mary's.
Yeah. Head to St. Mary's. We have several nuclear fallout shelters. I requested that we drink Japanese sake if you have it. I have multiple bottles, including one from, the Texas Sake Company, that is a sake that was brewed in rosé bottles.
Ooh, interesting.
Yeah, so I finally broke that out in my multiple sake pots and my multiple sake cups, though I'm a genius and forgot to clean out the one that I was planning on. Weebs of the internet, clean out your fucking sake pots. Clean them. Everyone go, because we tend to collect them. It's one of the few things that you can get that's, like, Japanese, and, like, everyone, as soon as you express any interest in Japan, they buy you 60 million sake sets. Even if you don't drink sake, they buy you 60 million sake sets. Go find your hoard of sake pots and just go clean all of them. All of you, go clean them. This is a reminder from an elder weeb. Go take out all your sake pots and give them a good rinse.
Clean that out. Clean it out now.
Including my favorite bottle, which is a Gekkikan bottle that the lid is a cup.
Oh, that's cool.
Because Japan truly is living in the future.
So are you a cold sake or hot sake drinker?
I'm a hot sake drinker, but I didn't have the energy. I have a warmer because of course I do. I have a sake warmer, but that would have taken too long because it's like warmed by candle. Because you don't just like throw a bottle of Gekkikan in the microwave. Like that's not
how. Yeah, I was wondering that. I'm like, do you nuke it or
it's basically a little double boiler. And it warms by tea light. I really want, like, a lot of Japanese restaurants have like these like fancy machines that like you do put it in like Gekkikan and like it just like dispenses hot sake. I'm a hot sake drinker. Apparently that's like a big dick energy move, especially for Americans, because whenever I order hot sake, everyone's always super impressed, and that weirds me out.
I do have to ask, what is a Gekkikan? Just because I honestly,
Gekkikan is a brand of sake.
Okay. Okay, because I was like, what is...
Yeah, Gekkikan is a brand. Yeah, don't get me started on sake talk, because I know too much about sake. It's one of my favorite alcohols. It has always been one of my favorites. It's probably, like, just under gin.
You and gin, there's a love story.
Me and gin, there's a love story. So, like, sake is probably, like, right under gin as far as, like, this is my drink. If I can have it, this is my drink. And then probably soju, because soju...
Soju will mess you up.
Soju.
Oh.
I love that we're running away from the book and just talking about us being old drunks.
So, yeah, intentionally. So, one of my friends, amazing, amazing person in California, she taught me about soju by getting one of those small watermelons, cutting it in half.
Yeah.
Together, blending it. We were flying. I mean... I don't know how we were functioning by the time like her roommates got home because Lord. No,
I went to Dallas, Fort Worth with one of my friends who's also like a big like Japanese and Asian culture fan. So I took her back home, which is full of that stuff. Like Dallas, Fort Worth, if you are a Koreaboo or a weeb, Dallas, Fort Worth is where you need to be. So I took her to like, huh?
I said, I had no idea.
Next time we need to go on like a I guess like a work trip, I'll show you. So we went to like my favorite Korean barbecue place. It's like this super like luxe pretty place. And we ordered this like pitcher of soju cocktails. It was green apple soju, ooh, Sprite, green apple syrup. And it came to us in a pitcher. I think each pitcher had like a bottle or two in it.
Oh God.
That was the best night of my life. We just kept ordering meat. It's just like, because soju goes down so smooth. Sake goes down super smooth. This is us talking about alcohol because we don't want to talk about this very, very sad book. In honor of what happened, my ceremonial sake drink. Oh, I love sake so much. So, we actually do have a short story. Long, because...
And it's really short.
It is really short, so we can talk even more about how sad we are about the state of the world.
And I will say, for the most part, the book gets it right for the most part, but there are some details that are different from the real story. So we'll talk about that in depth in a minute. But yes. First of all, story long. So Sadako was a young girl in Japan getting ready to go into junior high. Mm-hmm. She loves running, and her big dream is to get on the running team when she gets into junior high.
Mm-hmm.
Surprise! She gets leukemia instead, as she was a baby during the atomic bombing of Hiroshima. Mm-hmm. A friend of hers is visiting her in the hospital and tells her this legend that for those who make a 1,000 paper cranes, they can get a wish. And she's like, I'm going to start folding these and I'm going to live because I'm going to make that wish.
Yep.
In the book, she only manages to make 644 before dying in her sleep on October 25th of 1955. Her friends and family finish making the cranes and bury them with her. It's a very beautiful image. It's not actually what happened.
Yeah, okay. So, spoiler to something that we usually do at the end of the show. I read this when I was in school. And we folded paper cranes. Man, why do we make children? This is sad. This is just so sad. I think we read this in, like, it was in the same book of, like, The House on Mango Street and, like, Flowers for Algernon.
Yes! Oh my god, it was! It's it was like a big thing. Collection.
Yeah, the big, thick literature book.
I read this in, and now I remember. Okay.
See? Okay, yeah, Unlocking Hidden Trauma. It's this thick-ass literature text that's just full of, like, sad stories for children. I'm assuming it's what the collection...
Still do it the same way in elementary schools, because my daughter goes to a weird school, but they have... Fair. Usually most of the time they'll just read an actual book. Like,
yeah.
So, like over the summer you get like all of the books and then they can read them if they want.
We had one big literature text. Yeah. We had one big literature textbook. And in that big literature textbook, there was a million little stories. And like, mine was like, or sometimes they'd have like excerpts of bigger books in it. So like, I think mine had like excerpts of like To Kill a Mockingbird, but then like, we read like To Kill a Mockingbird because it's Texas. And we read To Kill a Mockingbird 1,000 times. And it had like the house on Mango Street. It had Flowers for Algernon. It had like some of Dicey's song, which is something that we ended up reading later. It had like parts of The Giver. What was that book full of just like sad child memories?
I don't know. It was like they just had these like giant literature collections that they would like give to schools, and they had them until they fell apart. One of the ones that we read in junior year honors English, I remember. It had a Dorothy Parker story in it about like this woman who had just gotten married and she's on the train with her husband going, I fucked up. And I remember reading that in class because I was so bored of whatever they were talking about. And that is when I fell in love with Dorothy Parker. And I was like, holy shit, this is amazing. And then we had to talk about something I didn't care about.
Oh my God, I think I found it. It was, it's either the Glencoe or the McDougal Little.
Oh my God. These are flashbacks, man.
Yeah, like I'm having like World War flashbacks because it's like it was just full. Yeah, this is it. Mine was the Glencoe literature book, and it was just full of like sad stories, and they were thick as fuck. Like in hindsight, you know, we would make the joke like thick enough to stop a bullet. That's a real concern now in schools, but like thick enough. That's a real concern now. We would joke about it less. Less prophetically when we were younger, even though we still grew up in the shadow of Columbine, but like thick enough to stop a bullet, just full of like truncated sad stories, and it had like questions at the end, and it was like, how did this make you feel? It made me feel fucking sad. It's about a girl dying of cancer because of a horrible choice that America made.
Yeah, under the pretense of we have to do this before the Russians do.
Yeah. So, okay, we're going to go straight into some World War II history and some Atomic Age history, which is shockingly like my third favorite phase of history to cover, just because it's so bonkers. Atomic Age history is just, what were any of us doing? What was anyone doing? So World War II is going on. And there's the war in Europe, which is what most people focus on, and the war in the East with Japan. Japan had done some things. Understatement of the century. Japan had been guilty of some war criming and and some human rights violations. Because no one talks about how bad Japan was during World War II. During his time, oftentimes, like, Hitler and Mussolini would look at what Japan was doing and was like, you guys need to calm down. Like, Japan was truly wild. And it is one of the craziest parts about, like, being, like, an anime and Japanese culture fan is, like, coming to grips with Japan's utter batshit years during World War II. So they were doing some war crimes, and a rape of Nanking happened, and then Pearl Harbor happened. And Pearl Harbor is the thing that everyone says turned the tide of war, because it got the Americans involved. And basically the Americans were like, hey, you just killed a bunch of like civilians and stuff, and you bombed two of our ships on our soil. Like, we cannot let this stand. This cannot stand. And there was, before FDR died, there was a desire to like show, hey, we're gonna like fuck shit up. Like, we're gonna do something crazy. We just don't know what it is yet. And there had been bombings and shellings in the past. FDR dies and the next president takes over and is like, oh yeah, like I'm all for fucking shit up. Like, let's go. We have this new crazy thing. Let's give it a try. Here's the thing. Hiroshima and Nagasaki were both planned cities. These weren't accidents. These weren't like, oh no, like, you know, the bomb fell off mysteriously because everyone's like, well, why didn't you bomb Tokyo? Why didn't you bomb Okinawa? First, I don't have time for your I'm secretly an armchair historian stuff. This was planned. There was a reason why it was those two cities. In fact, Hiroshima had at the time considered themselves very, very lucky that they were relatively low on the cities that had been shelled. So it was definitely a point to bomb Hiroshima and Nagasaki. The two bombs that went over Fat Man and Little Boy were complete. Like, this was an entirely new concept of war. One thing people kept saying on the ground was, this is a brand new kind of bomb. Like, immediately people knew that this was bad. Immediately people knew that this was different. Immediately people were aware that this wasn't good. And it was, when we talk about decimation being like a removal of a, you know, particular subsect of people, this was truly a decimation. This killed so many people instantly, and the effects are something that are still being felt to this day. Not just the cancer, but the trauma. Our choice to use nuclear weapons is something that Americans to this day do not know how to feel about. To this day, Americans don't know how to feel about it. And to this day, Japan doesn't know how to feel about Americans because of it. And they have every right to feel that way. So, it was bad.
What gets really crazy, too, is when you start looking into the personalities behind the Manhattan Project.
Yes.
And all the different facilities that started to grow up. And this is actually where a lot of, like, UFO people and conspiracy theory people and the historians overlap, is this desire to do everything super secret, because one, they're like, well, we protect our people, but there's a big issue. So Einstein, at one point in time, he had come to the United States. He wrote a letter to the president and was like, you need to be aware that there are a lot of German scientists who were working on rocket propulsion and bomb theory and all sorts of to try and win. So you need to be aware of these people, and you need to be aware that that was something that was happening, because the Russians were also trying to court all these scientists who basically were in a collapsing society. The United States did the same thing after the war. We had what is called Operation Paperclip, and what's interesting about that is the paperclip thing, it wasn't, that's not officially what it was called. What it was called that because what would happen is if there was a particular scientist, Nazi or not, usually Nazi, they would put a paperclip on it and be like, we want this guy. So we had, and I will be honest with you, we would not have had NASA, we would not have gone to space without some of these scientists. And they were just living out here, living their lives. Like, but what, and I'm not saying that in awe, I'm saying that in horror, but it was a very big deal. It was very quiet. In the United States and in the UK and in a couple of places, after a certain period of time, documents are released, explaining certain things. And there are still files that are released that are redacted. We're starting to see a lot of the Kennedy stuff come forward. There's a lot of things that are, that come out over time and you go, oh shit, same thing happens in the UK. But as we go on, you will just start seeing more and more stuff about it. The reason we don't have stuff about like the CIA's MK Ultra program is because Sidney Gottlieb and the rest of the people in that program intentionally destroyed documents because they knew that they were going to get in trouble. Conspiracy.
Here's the thing. I think it's important to listen to the people that are still alive that were affected by this. There was a documentary that I watched, actually, when we recorded last time. It was The Day the Bomb Dropped. And it had a lot of the pilots and everything that are still alive. And, like, they regret it. Here's something that's wild to me, is how unilaterally almost everyone involved regretted being a part of this.
Yes.
That is something that blows my mind. There are people that were involved, that flew those planes, that made those bombs, that were there, that regret what we did, and say that loudly, emphatically. And that's, I think, the most important thing. That's one of the reasons why I struggled so much with Oppenheimer, with people like leaving, like, oh yeah, Oppenheimer was the greatest guy, and like, look at him, he was great, he was such a Chad scientist. He didn't say, I've become the destroyer of worlds because he felt good. Like, that was not like a positive statement for him.
He was quoting the Bhagavad Gita. Like, he was quoting because he couldn't think of anything to say other than, oh shit, let me quote this guy turning into Shiva.
Because, you know, all the ancient alien scientist bros needed him to quote the Bhagavad Gita.
I was going to wear my Barbenheimer shirt today, and I didn't. I haven't seen either movie, so I kind of feel like I can't. But
no, you can. You can. You can. Also, yeah, fun fact, ancient alien bros loved the Bhagavad Gita. Oh my god, ancient alien bros. Do you remember when we thought that ancient aliens was like a thing? Do you remember that?
Yeah, no, it's an incredibly racist theory, but Eric Von Doniggen was very convincing.
I think also, like, we cannot ignore, like, just the memification of Giorgio Tsoukalos. Because, like, sometimes he does make a point. It's usually stupid, but he makes a point.
Giorgio is actually a very lovely person in real life.
He's a really nice guy! He's just...
So, I don't know if I've talked about this. I think I've talked about this on the show before, about going to contact in the desert as a reporter. And seeing, like, George Norrie and stuff, and a bunch of people who are like, oh my god. And seeing Eric Von Doniggen swearing, which was hilarious because his projector wouldn't work.
I love that for you.
Giorgio is very, very sweet. He's a very nice guy. Yeah, Nick Redfern's weird, but he's cool. Also, Giorgio at the time was married. I don't know if he's still married to the same woman. I haven't looked it up. She was smoking hot. She was a yoga instructor. She was gorgeous. And she's like manning his table. And I'm like, dude, ancient aliens pays real good, right?
Like, hey, so yeah, I've read the Egyptian Book of the Dead. I have some questions about light bulbs, the Baghdad Battery. I can talk about the Baghdad Battery, the Ark of the Covenant. We're running away from this book. One of my favorite things about ancient aliens is how much it tries to rationalize that, like, atomic stuff happened, like, in prehistory. Like, they say that's what happens, like, the Indus River Valley situation, is that there was an atomic bomb. And it's like, okay. Okay, guys.
So, something really scary to tell some people who may or may not call Georgia home. Off the coast of Savannah, there is a possible nuclear weapon. These pilots were doing a test, and they had to kind of bail out. But they dropped the payload, which may or may not be a nuclear bomb. It's currently off the coast of Savannah. It was more dangerous to try and remove it than to leave it. And so I'm always like going, because my husband is from Savannah. And so he's like, we should go back and visit. And I'm like, oh, no. I don't want to die.
Oh, my God. It's amazing. It's amazing.
Getting killed at the Waffle House.
Oh, it's amazing. But the atomic age was crazy, and we're still learning the lasting effects that have come out of it. What I think people don't always understand is just the intense real-time effects of the bomb and the bombings. There are some truly horrific photos online, because that's the other thing. We have photos. Mm-hmm. We have graphic photos. My favorite is one, it's the Americans that don't think it happened, or two, that don't think it was that bad.
Freshman year of high school, our teacher propping out these photos and me almost throwing up is one that will haunt me for the rest of my life, of a woman who was wearing a kimono.
Yep.
And it burned the pattern into her back. And
yeah,
oh my god.
Like, yeah. People with these, and they're black and white photos, but you can see these gaping wounds, dude. You can see where they've been burned so severely that their body is just doing anything it can to try and protect itself.
Yeah.
It is horrifying.
And so I went down a really, really weird rabbit hole of, I was really, really fascinated by people that died in atomic accidents. It's one of the reasons why I built a demon core lamp, is I'm really, really fascinated by people who die in atomic accidents, because I need more things to be that creepy guy in your history class.
I think you're succeeding.
I think I've won. I think at making a demon core lamp, I win. But, like, there's just something that's so uniquely horrible about death due to radiation and radiation sickness. Hisashi Uchi comes to mind. Do not listen to the story of Hisashi Uchi lightly or on an empty stomach. That is a man who received a horrifying amount of radiation and was essentially kept alive as an experiment just to see how far they could push what the body could go through. And it's sad and tragic. There was that one video that I sent you in the same day that I sent you the Alyoshenka video of this guy in Brazil who came across this like horrifying beam of light that like disintegrated him, that no one knows what happened outside of like, it looks like he came in contact with something that was radioactive, which is still one of the most fascinating stories. I wish I knew what happened. Please someone tell me what happened to that.
You know, it's funny. That's also a very popular story in the UFO circles.
I wonder why, Victoria.
Well, and interestingly enough, okay, what is fascinating is how many UFO stories interlace with fairy stories. And I'm not going down that rabbit hole right now because we will be here all day.
And we will be.
I'm just saying, I'm going to name a book that is absolutely amazing if you want to read about weird ass shit. I've been reading. I'm worried. It's called A Trojan Feast. It's by Joshua Cutchin. He also has some books on Bigfoot, which are amazing.
Yeah, I have those on my wish list.
It's cool, dude. Cool, dude. I've seen him talk before at a museum event. He's a good guy. But yeah, anyway, back to these beams of light. So what's crazy, too, is that a lot of scientists, when they initially started experimenting with uranium and separating different portions and and working to get the chain reaction that would set off more chain reactions, would create an atomic blast. That's really what happens with it. Mm-hmm. They didn't necessarily take a lot of precautions. And so a lot of people got very sick.
Yes.
Also, the Air Force and a couple other groups have this tendency to just burn stuff that they don't want other people to find. And unfortunately, those chemicals tend to lead to things like cancer.
And or they bury it.
Or they bury it. And unfortunately, there have been like Lockheed Martin employees have sued the U.S. government before. Yeah. And then like everything has been locked down because they're like, we don't want people to know what we have.
Yeah.
And that's not even a UFO theory thing, guys. That's the fact that...
Like that's just... Yeah. The American military industrial complex is a fascinating and horrible creature that I guess treats negative things like I treat emotions. Just bury it down deep enough and hope it never resurfaces. You just bury it down deep enough. But the problem is that doesn't work with like radioactive fallout material. Like you can't just throw that in a hole.
Water table.
Yeah, like you can't just throw that in a hole and be like, it's gone, don't worry about it.
Nuclear stuff is really, it's interesting and terrifying at the same time. It's a fascinating power. It is.
It's truly one of the most complicated things to grapple with because we are aware of its immense power. But we are also aware of its immense destruction. There is a reason that hitherto this point, this kind of stuff has not been used again. Everyone is aware of how terrifying that this is. Kurzgesagt, I'm sure I'm butchering that. They're like a crash course almost style YouTube channel that is just full of like existential dread and cute birds. me, they talk a lot about like what would happen like in a nuclear winter and stuff like that. And it's like, yeah, this is horrible. So here's the thing to take away. One, the atomic age is a complicated age that Americans don't know how to approach, because here's the other part of it. America does not know what to do with the legacy left in the wake of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. Because acknowledging that we fucked up that bad is really hard. But especially as we come to grips increasingly with what Japan was doing during World War II, while I would never say that what we did was proportionate, I also don't know what would have stopped Japan during that time. Now, I'm not a president, I'm not a historian, I'm not anything. But I don't know what would have stopped Japan during that time. Do I think that what we did was the answer? In hindsight, no. But I don't have a solution, and I admit that. I wish more people that like this period of history could acknowledge that. That none of us have a solution. None of us have an answer.
Oh, none of us do. If something I've learned the older I've gotten is if somebody claims to have all the answers, they're full of shit.
Yes. That's why we're so skeptical about religion. It's like anything that claims to have the answers to everything is incredibly suspicious to us. It's very sus to us. Let's talk about the human cost of war, because I think when we talk about death toll and everything, I think sometimes those numbers just sort of like wash over, especially Americans. Mm-hmm. But a lot of people died.
And those who didn't suffered lifelong, not just trauma. I mean, it was, it's a generational infection. I mean, there were kids who were born to people who were in the blast who developed mm-hmm. things like leukemia or birth defects or both. Mm-hmm. There were people who ended up developing horrific sores and stuff that eventually took them out. People lost their ability to fight like with their immune systems in a lot of cases. I mean, it's bad. It's really, really bad.
Right.
And it's just like, that's not necessarily something we like to talk about, especially in history. We'll be like, here's the big number. This many people died. And then it's like, okay, but how many people survived and are still suffering? And that's like when Amanda says things like there are still places in Japan that don't like Americans, and that's fair. That's why.
Right.
You remember grandma dying, you know, like you remember your great aunt screaming in pain as she died from leukemia. Like you don't, it's not like.
And it's not something that goes away. Like it is a generational trauma akin to like what African Americans have with slavery. That like, it doesn't matter how far removed you are away from it. There are still things that my family does to protect itself that are generational echoes from that initial trauma. I got to go to the African-American Smithsonian when I was in D.C. Mandatory for, I think, every human being. Also, shocked at the sheer amount of white people that were there. Both, like, positively and negatively. It's like, one, this doesn't, like, absolve you. Like, you don't, like, go in here and it's like, you're free. this is not samsara. Like, you don't go in here like, this is my black penance, and, like, you release from the system. But two, when you put everything in one place, it's almost hard to imagine that, like, this is not something that stopped. And that's one thing that I left that museum still thinking, is that it feels like that history just stopped. That the oppression just stopped. That one day in the 1960s, you know, a switch flipped and everything was fine. And then we got, you know, civil rights and integration and Obama was president. But that's not true. there is still police brutality. There are modern day lynchings. There are still these things that happen that are echoes of old generational trauma. The same can be said in Japan. It is one of the most interesting things to me about being like an anime fan in America is watching anime that I know that is not for me that takes jabs at Americans constantly. There is no more self-deprecating group than anime fans. Because that media is constantly talking about how shitty and awful Americans are. Because it's not media made for us. Every series I watched getting into that fandom was constantly talking about how awful Americans are, how terrible America is, how inept and awful American politics are. And that's weird. That's weird when you are so into something that is negging you constantly.
It's really fascinating because so much media is made in the United States and allies and stuff that we don't necessarily see. It's when you start watching foreign films or you start watching things from other countries. And with the internet, now we have that option. We're seeing
things we've
never seen before, movies that we never would have seen, especially in places like Russia and the Ukraine and like Eastern Europe. There's a lot of stuff that comes out. We're like, I had no idea. But yeah, when it's not putting on the kid gloves for politics, it's you will hear a lot of things. When Bush was president and he was reelected, I remember being in high school and I was, or not high school, I was in college and we were getting ready to like, I was studying things about going to study abroad and stuff. I hadn't gone yet. But how people were like in other countries going, what is wrong with you guys? Are you okay? Like, do you need help? Blink twice. And like when you went to the, when I went to the UK, when I was in Scotland, I mean, people were excited because of things like the OC, but they at the same time, like there is constant teasing. There is constant teasing. There was a dude who was almost in a bar fight at one point in time, got pushed up against the wall and somebody's yelling in his face. Cause it was during like World Cup. He's like, who's your team? And the guy like can't talk. And the other guy walks up to him and goes, he's wearing jeans. He's clearly an American. He goes, sorry, mate, and drops him. Like, what? But then,
it shit happens. It happens. And it's
in Scotland. They're not going to throw you up against the wall, guys. It was at a bar. It's a whole other thing. Don't worry about it.
Thank you. I hope Scotland sends you a nice press package for that bit of PR.
Whatever. No, seriously. Yeah. I would go to Scotland right now if I could. I'd just be like stinky in my pajamas on the plane. I don't care. I want to go home.
Yeah, I would go anywhere that isn't here right now. But it's amazing to think about the fact that like, so here's another cool cultural thing that if you have a lot of friends that like anime, especially in the early 2000s, it's amazing how many fans were black. Because we have this thing called cultural detachment. A lot of African Americans super fell into watching anime because it provided a cultural model that was critical of the US. Because we didn't have a way to express that. I was born in the 90s. I didn't have a model to express distaste in the US until the 2000s. And then like post 9/11, you had a lot of ways to express distaste in America. But during like the early times and even like now, well, I mean, now it's very in vogue to hate America for valid reasons, but it's very in vogue to hate America now. But when you had these like systemic issues with the US, it was so hard to express those things and you didn't know how to. One way that a lot of people did it was by culturally detaching entirely and essentially becoming like Japanese expats. And you just ingest all this media that is so negative about your own country. And it's weird. It's so weird. And the other thing, and I say this because I was a Japanese Culture Club president. I was a president in high school and in college. Do not ever forget that Japan has its own racism. Please do not ever forget.
And that's something I want to point out too. We may make jabs at our systems and oppression and stuff like that because it's valid to criticize a system that hurts people. It's valid.
It is.
But at the same time, every single country has their thing. Even Canada. Especially even Canada.
Especially Canada.
Like we'll sit here and pontificate about how shitty Russia is all day long, but like, come on, guys. We have razor wire at the borders in between these little buoy things because our governor thinks it's a good idea. Oh my God. So the human rights abuses at the border are just horrifying.
We don't have time to talk about those. We'll be here all day. We'll be here all day. But Japan has this.
Yes. Tip him into the river. Tip him in.
My favorite shirt. Throw Abbott into the river. Just yeet. But to talk about the book, because we could be here all day whinging about how much we hate the U.S. That could be a whole separate podcast of Amanda and Tori whinge about the U.S. But also...
And Tori backpedals because she doesn't want to get kicked out.
Yeah, and Amanda backpedals feverishly because she's a brown person on the internet who has opinions. We need to talk about the... just the lasting echoes of that we still have, because I think what we tend to do, especially here in the West, is that we think that like we drop the bomb, everything's fine. And then like the Cold War happened and no one talked about that. So Tori and I are both of a generation that we still have a lot of very, very rational angst about there being nuclear war again. Because our parents grew up in a generation that was a massive concern.
My favorite sci-fi series right now involves an atomic bomb that is set off by somebody. So, like, it is definitely something that is still in our consciousness, and it needs to be. That's the thing I want to emphasize, is, like we were talking about at the beginning, as, you know, generations pass and as history goes a little bit farther, even if it's not that far, we tend to forget how horrifying something was or how detrimental and destructive something was. And yes. So, you know, we as a millennial generation make a bunch of jokes about horrifying things because it's how we get through the day. But yes. Like at the same time, we need to understand that Russia's still threatening to use atomic bombs. They're still threatening other countries that are supporting Ukraine. Now, what extent they have that weaponry, we don't know. We do know what the we have a concept of what the U.S. has. Something that still blows my fucking mind is one of the reasons people were so hesitant about the UK, well, England leaving, come on, Tori, you can do this, the EU, leaving,
yes,
we're really a full part of it anyway, but leaving that is if Scotland had voted on the referendum to become independent.
What do you do with all the weapons?
What do you do with the weapons? Because Scotland, where the UK stores all their nuclear weapons, which is like,
and that's sometimes
you already like destroyed the Scots. What is wrong with you? Okay, they didn't destroy the Scots we live on, but I'm just saying, like, you've already done enough. Okay. We remember Colossus.
Relax.
Shanks. Okay, I'm back.
Oh my God. So I remember that being mentioned when Last Week Tonight with John Oliver covered it. That was one of the big things that he talked about, is what do you do with the weapons? And that's a big thing that I think a lot of people during the Scottish indie ref, that like no one had an answer to that. Here's the thing. We cannot go back to a time where we don't have atomic weapons.
Right.
We can't just magic them away. I wish we could. Every major superpower has them. My concerns are less Russia and more North Korea.
Oh yeah, no, that's terrifying. I'm right there with you.
to fully become an arm. Yeah, to fully become like a tinfoil hat wearing armchair, you know, guy who listens to the CB radio for conspiracy information. My concern,
dark web generation. Come on.
The dark web scares me. I don't like it.
As it should.
Yeah, it scares me. I'm that person who like Googles how to enter dark web. Like, that's me. I'm like in Google, like how to enter dark web. There's so many concerns that we have, and we can't let the dragon back out. Like, we can't put the dragon back in the bottle. The dragon's out. It's what we do with it. I am encouraged by the fact that so many of us do have this very rational and valid fear that nuclear war is something that we are all afraid of and we are all trying very hard to avoid. It's one of the big reasons now there's a lot of collaboration, we'll say, in Asia happening, because North Korea has been doing some stuff and Japan is terrified, as they should, considering what happened to Korea. But we're not going to talk about that because, you know, Japan was wilding for a while. The only way to properly say it, Japan did have a period where they were wilding. It's scary to think about, but it's also this like untapped potential. Like, nuclear energy could save the world. Like, we're talking like Tony Stark level. Like, this could save the world. It's not, because we keep using it for weapons, but it could.
And honestly,
yes,
the reason things didn't work out with like Chernobyl and a couple plants and stuff like that, and the ones in Japan, is when there's an issue, when there's a major issue, when something gets broken, or something isn't repaired properly, and that's when it tends to fall apart, because it is powerful. This is horrifying, world-ending shit. Like,
right,
the chain reactions don't just stop because you want them to.
Right, like, you can't. I mean, we saw that with Hisashi Uchi, where it was like, I'm going to throw myself over the core and see if that stops it. You've done nothing. It's particles. That's why it's scary. But to go back to the paper cranes, because I feel like we've done a lot of like doomerism. The crane myth is real. Origami is still a very, very well-practiced art in Japan, and one practiced by anxious children all across America. Because I feel like we just went through a phase in like the 90s and the 2000s where we were just folding paper cranes. Like, that was like one of the first big like culturally appropriative things I remember coming over from Japan. Like, before I even knew about like Japan as a country, I knew origami.
Do you remember the bracelets?
Yes, I do. I do remember those. So that is true. And I do remember, as part of reading this, we had to fold paper cranes. And to try to have a little bit of positivity about this, there are still organizations to this day that focus on folding these paper cranes as a sign of peace and solidarity that help raise money to support survivors and to support peace. The biggest message out of this book isn't to hate on Americans, and it isn't to hate on Japan for what happened. It's that the end goal should be peace. There's a reason why at these places that there are peace monuments. The goal is to abolish war, because war is this terrifying, all-encompassing, costly, both financial, emotional, spiritual thing. And to never go back to where we were. The point is progress. That dropping the bombs was something that we need to grow past. That we did it. It was like a bad, rebellious teenage act. And no one should ever do it again. That's the tone of this book. That's the tone of most people who survived, who continue to protest, who continue to express shock, anger, and disappointment, is that this was a bad thing that happened twice and it should never happen again.
And it would have been bad enough if we had just done Hiroshima.
Yeah, that would have been.
But we went on. We did Nagasaki.
Yeah. So the folding of the cranes is a true thing. And you know what? Go fold some paper cranes. I order a lot of things from Japan and I still get like little paper cranes in a lot of my packages. Sometimes if I have the energy, I will fold them myself. Because again, origami was one of those weird things that I remember coming over very, very quickly. A lot of Japanese culture came to the U.S. in fragments because we injected all of our culture into Japan very, very quickly. That's called the Marshall Plan. It's a reason why Japan loves certain American brands. There is no greater dystopian hell than going to a country where American culture is commodified. It is the weirdest thing. That was the weirdest part about being in Japan, was just how many American things that there were and how much they just fucking love it. I will never forget being in Osaka. I went to Universal and I managed, my friend group and I went to the Bubba Gump Shrimp Company in Osaka, Japan.
Who? Okay, that's the weirdest thing is if you watch that movie or read that book, who would have thought it would become this like international chain in like,
right.
It's ridiculous.
Right. And, you know, not that it would become an international chain, because I can get it like a Margaritaville. Like, it's kind of like niche and weird. But in Osaka, Japan, that's where we went to lunch before we went to Universal. Universal is full of, like, mostly these, like, American properties, these Western properties. Like, Jaws. I saw so much Jaws merch there. Y'all don't give a fuck about Jaws. You don't. Jurassic Park, like, you guys don't care. It was so weird watching like the commodification of American culture. That is the most batshit thing. Frankly, I think we deserve it. We deserve every bit of it. But do you want to talk about this writer who essentially is just like me, a giant weeb?
What's really interesting about this writer too is there is not a whole lot of information. This is like the peak strategy as a writer. This is what I think I would like.
Disappear.
Leave me the fuck alone. I wrote one book. Actually, she wrote a few books, but that's good. So Eleanor Corp, she was born in Comstock, Saskatchewan in Canada on May 29th, 1922. She was raised in Saskatoon. Yay. She was really big on reading and writing, as every author that we've come across. I don't think I've ever seen one description of somebody's personal history that was like, man, I hated reading. When she was in high school, her best friend was a child of Japanese immigrants who had come to Canada, or not Canada, I think they were in the U.S. because I think she's up near Alaska. So she got really into Japanese calligraphy, Japanese food, origami. She was like, this is the coolest stuff I've ever seen.
She's just like me. Yeah.
She went to the University of Saskatchewan. She got her bachelor's degree from the University of Maryland. And then she was working as a newspaper reporter. She edited the kids' home, so she knew, you know, kind of how to write down to children. The ultimate goal of writing to children is not writing down to them, but writing complex things in a way that makes it really easy to understand.
Correct.
Anyway, she taught children's literature at Monterey Peninsula College, and then she later did creative writing at Chapman College in California. She married a former U.S. ambassador to Uruguay. His name was Wimberly Duren Corr. So interesting, that gave her the opportunity to do a lot of travel. He ended up dying of Parkinson's in 1996, but she had traveled with him to like multiple countries, including Japan, Taiwan, Thailand, Brazil, and the Philippines. So she was all over. She wrote her first book in 1945, but kind of left it to the side and didn't get into publishing until the 60s. After her husband died, she became really reclusive, and she stayed in her private homes in Pebble Beach, California, and Henderson, Nevada. So, I mean, like, doing pretty good there. Mm-hmm. She died November 22nd, 2010, at 88 years old, and both she and her husband were cremated. So, this August is actually the perfect time to do this book and talk about
where
it's from. August 6th is the Hiroshima Remembrance Day and a Day of Peace.
Absolutely.
Just past that. I promised you I was going to tell you the real story of Sadako. Her brother and another writer actually came forward and eventually wrote a book, The Real Story, so that people would know exactly what happened.
Yes.
She was 2 years old during the bombing of Hiroshima. She did really pass away from bomb-related leukemia at the age of 12. According to her family, she actually exceeded the goal of making 1,000 cranes. So she made more than that. Obviously, the witch didn't come true. But when she died, there was a total of about 1,450.
Good job.
So a lot. Her brother, Mashiro Sakai, and his family donated the cranes to major places to be seen. Mm-hmm. So they've been at the National September 11th Museum, the Pearl Harbor Museum, the Harry S. Truman Presidential Library, and also the Museum of Tolerance. Mm-hmm. After she passed away, her classmates actually put together a group of letters, and they decided to build a memorial to her and all the kids who died from the after effects of the atomic bomb. So it's a very powerful memorial. Her brother, like I said, helped put out a book with Sue DeCiccio, I think it is. I'm like, get so confused because we talk Greek half the time. 1999, the statue of Sadako holding a ruby crane was put at the Hiroshima Peace Park, and there's a plaque on it that says, "This is our cry, this is our prayer, peace on earth," which is sad. Yeah. So, and Amanda probably knows a lot more about this than I do. So there's the Japanese festival of Obon, which is celebrated to remember the dead. So if I understand, they clean the graves, they leave gifts, they hang out with their family members. And so, during that, then that they'll leave additional cranes near the statue.
100%. And it's important to consider. So, you know, Obon, sort of like, you know, a day of the dead. It's a grave cleaning day. It is a day to honor the dead and honor the lost. I still do celebrate some Obon traditions because I'm a level 500 anime nerd. And, you know, the crane, obviously, symbol of peace and beauty. And the whole point of origami is that it's a meditative art. It's that you're folding and it's intentional. That is something that is a huge part of Japanese culture, is intentionality. And that's something that I think is amazing that Americans don't always understand. So do you remember that phase when everyone loved those like 3D origami stars?
Yes.
Yes, I do. And then people would just buy them. The point is that you make it yourself. The point is that you go through this exercise. My favorite is as people have to make walls like I have, where they have like these elaborate streaming walls, you can buy like wreaths of origami cranes. And it's like, you're missing the point. The point of origami is that you do this, is that you go through these intentions, that you fold this paper. It is a part of a greater Japanese tradition that includes things like kintsugi and wabi-sabi, that there is an intentionality to it. My other favorite part about Japanese culture and it missing the mark in America is kintsugi, which is repairing defects with gold. So sometimes you'll see kintsugi bowls a lot. And the point is that you fix this imperfection with gold, and it's meant to be like a sign of like personhood, that your imperfections are there and that you should highlight them, but you know, you fill them in with things that make you stronger. It is the more poetic part of what doesn't kill you makes you stronger. But then it got really, really popular in the US. So there'd be people who were like, buy a bowl, break it in half. And it's like, no, you're missing the point. The point isn't to go buy a whole bowl, fuck it up, and then make it pretty. Like, you don't get a child, traumatize them, and hope they write the great next American novel.
I mean, some people do.
Some people do. There's some kid right now who's going through it just so they can write the next great American novel.
Haunted by the ghost of William Faulkner.
Just, oh my God, just haunted every day by Salinger and everything. But the point wasn't to go buy, to take a brand new bowl, break it, and then make it pretty. The point was that something irrevocable happened in the journey of this item. And due to frugality and a desire to mend, that we fix it, that we become whole again. The point wasn't just take a hammer to a bowl and break it, or like people that would like have like pottery studios and like intentional defects in the bowl. Because again, like, it's, I've loved kintsugi because I relate a lot to it as being someone who was broken and has done their best to fill in their, you know, flaws with gold. There's also a death cab for cutie album named kintsugi.
I did not know that.
There is. It's one of, some of my favorite songs are on that album. But the point wasn't like, if you approached it like that, like, yeah, like you don't like take a child and traumatize them in hopes that they become great. Like, that's, you're not intentionally traumatizing the child or like going through something in hopes that you go through that, in hopes that you bring out art. That's the wrong way to look at it. But yeah, I when I was shopping for my giant excessive wall of decorations, I saw a lot of like, oh, here's a bunch of origami cranes. And it's like, the whole point is that you make them, or that they're a gift. That's the other big thing, is that they're a gift. They're meant to, you know, be received. It's amazing that like when I order things from Japan, that I still get a lot of them, because there is, of course, a not subtle dig at giving an American a bunch of origami cranes. That's not unintentional. When I import things in from Japan, it is not a just kind gesture that in almost all of these packages, I get a bunch of origami cranes. And I keep all of them. Right. Like, that's one of those things that I don't think a lot of Americans think about. We just don't. Like, we're bad about thinking of ourselves in a context that isn't us. I think that's one of the best and worst parts about being a fan of, like, other cultures is looking at America from a non-American lens, because it kind of makes it really hard to like a lot of things that America does, but it also makes it really hard to just exist anywhere.
That's why for a long time there was that joke, if you were traveling abroad, just tell people you're from Canada. Because there's a reputation, and it is a serious person. This is something just to keep in mind as I pontificate from like almost 40. If you are polite and you are kind and you are genuinely interested and you want to participate, people are usually pretty cool about it. If you are loud and brash and flash your money around and are a dick to servers and are mean to museum people and call something stupid that you don't understand, you are not welcome. And that's, it's just basic manners, folks. Like, you don't get on the freaking metro or whatever and start talking shit about the guy sitting next to you. Like, you, when you go to visit another culture, you are visiting another culture. You
right,
are,
like, you are, you're a guest.
It's not you get to go and be like, let me tell you everything about myself. You are, the point of traveling is to understand more of the world, to understand how other people live, and to embrace that and realize that not everything is about you.
Right. And it's, you're right. Like, it does carry a reputation with it. And that's amazing, because you're like, I can't escape it being African-American. You know, white people, they get to pass and say they're from anywhere. I don't get to do that being African-American, because I'm either from Africa, which no one likes. Everyone is still super racist against Africans. Or I'm obviously an American. Like, I don't pass for anything that isn't an American. I'm way too fat. I'm way too fat to pass for anything that isn't an American.
Did you see the movie Nobody?
Yes.
With the, okay, the whole part about the black guy being Russian, and like every single person went, wait, what?
Yeah. Yeah, it's crazy. When I was in Austria, no one was convinced that I was an American. They also couldn't wrap their heads around me being Texan because I was too smart.
And that is the crazy thing, you guys, because what other countries hear about us, you know how sometimes we'll hear the weirdest story out of Germany, or we'll hear something really stupid that happened in Russia? Those are the kind of stories that reach other countries. That's why people know about Florida Man in Europe. They assume Texans are fast talking.
Still Walker, Texas Ranger.
Yeah, they still think we watched Walker, Texas Ranger. They think that we would ride an atomic bomb. They think that we are destructive as fuck. Like, it's just, that's what comes out. There's reasons people think certain things about California. There are things about York, and a lot of it is media, and a lot of it is the jokes and just the little slivers that get out through media in other countries. That's
all. Well, and also that, like, it isn't always false. So, like, one thing that a lot of Americans will internalize about Japanese media is that one thing that Japan thinks a lot about Americans is that we're very, very loud. That is true. In comparison to Japan, we are. That is the one thing that was the hardest to deal with, was being silent on, like, public transit. Because, like, we would take, so it was me, Carlos, and Ricky. We all went to Japan together. Being on the bullet train and, like, not talking to your friend, being on a bus and not talking to your friend, being, like, on a train or whatever and not talking to your friend, fucking weird. This is my best friend of over 10 years. What do you mean sit here in silence as we're on this train for an hour? What? And, like, you know, we coped, you know, we still talk to each other, but, like, being the only source of noise on a train, really fucking weird. Being, like, the only people talking, like, on a bus, really, really fucking weird. Like, being the only people that like stood out, obviously, like in a cafe or like at a restaurant was really, really weird. That was always, that was probably the strangest part about being in Japan, was embracing the, like, I am always going to be the loud American and I cannot stop that. I'm never not going to be the loud American because that's how I was raised. That's what I was doing. But I think here's where we'll wrap up. I think it's important to remember that history is complex. There's multiple sides to everything. And that we are still to this day grappling with the legacy of the choices that we've made. I mean, I think that's true about everything in, well, obviously that's true about everything everywhere, but it's like to our American listeners, we are still grappling with the decisions that we made hundreds of years ago, 50 years ago, 20 years ago, 10 years ago, 5 years ago.
Two years ago.
We're still grappling with the decisions that we make on a regular basis. And what will change perceptions is how we move forward. The problem is that we're not moving forward. And a lot of that is on us. It isn't anyone else. There isn't, you know, oh, the world is conspiring to make America look bad. It's not a narcissistic parent situation. We haven't gotten better. I remember being in high school and being Japanese Culture Club president and like, having like a one of the football players like say like, oh yeah, I thought we bombed Japan out of existence. It's like, first of all, that's horrible. Second of all, that's not how islands work. Third of all, why would you say that? Why would you say that to the president of the Japanese Culture Club? Why? If you would like to learn more about this stuff, we will have plenty of resources listed. Go into them with some grace. Sake is wonderful to help deaden the feeling of existential dread, because there is no way to feel more complex about human existence than to dive into talking about America's atomic age.
You
want to question everything? Dive into America's atomic age. Honestly, World War II, just on a whole, I mean, this is going to sound really, really stupid. It's just such a fucking downer. World War II is such a downer. Because, you know, to praise a movie that we talk about all the time, The King's Man. One of the things I loved about The King's Man, not just Ralph Fiennes being really, really hot and bisexual Rasputin, was that they really highlighted on World War I's desire that this should be it. We're not doing this anymore. This was bad, guys. Like, we're not doing... This is stupid. Do you see how many people have died? This is terrible. It was one of the good things that that movie did, was really highlight on that, like, especially European desire. Like, we're not fucking doing this again. This was terrible. All these people are dead. And as we grow closer and closer to the prefaces of war all over, it is important to remember peace, to remember where we stand in the grand scheme of things. Because much like all the radioactive things in Chernobyl, nature will continue on long past us.
Including the babushkas.
Including a more mainstream YouTuber covered the case of Alyoshenka, that weird little alien baby that was found. And I don't think I ever want the story of Alyoshenka to come out. I think that needs to like stay like on the internet. I don't think anyone, I don't want like a BuzzFeed documentary on Alyoshenka.
We're good. So there is an animated version of this movie.
Yes, there is.
It's in the same vein as Watership Down, where you're like, you're going to cry and you're going to hate your life.
Yeah.
There was supposed to be a movie that they were filming. I want to say it was around 2019 of it, but then there are no additional records after that. Cause I went down and like was going through Wikipedia to see if there was another movie. And it was like a bunch of articles about casting. I think it was Evan Rachel Woods or something. And then it was like nothing.
Yeah.
I couldn't find any links to it. Yeah. So if it did ever come out, never knew about it.
Yeah. Also, literally, like, if you want to talk, if you want to look at, like, there's a ton of, so much anime talks about World War II and that. Grave of the Fireflies is obviously going to be the one that I recommend. It's so sad.
Well, that's like somebody was joking about, like, if you watched Miyazaki films, like, it's kind of like they were comparing it to, like, Barbie and Oppenheimer. Like, you don't watch Totoro and then watch Grave of the Fireflies because then you're going to have a bummer. You reverse it. And I'm like, oh my God, it's true, though. Because you have, like, Totoro's all cute and stuff. And then all of a sudden you have, like, World War II and destruction and death. And no.
Well, and then the amazing thing.
People get sick.
Here's the thing I love about Miyazaki, especially, is that you can tell his very obvious anti-American sentiment, and you can tell his resentment. It's very, very obvious. And my favorite thing, and I hate doing the whole, like, Americans are dumb thing, but it's one of my favorite parts about being, like, a media critic who is very, very fond of Japanese media. Americans have never understood how much Miyazaki resents us. They have never understood it. We watch movies like Howl's Moving Castle, and we ignore, like, Nausicaa of the Wind Valley and Lupita, and we ignore Grave of the Fireflies, and we ignore all these movies. We ignore the part of Spirited Away that was so anti-capitalist that Disney almost did not pick up that movie. The whole point of Spirited Away is that it is an anti-capitalist, anti-consumerist movie, and then Disney licensed it and made it mainstream and popular. But we all remember the soot sprites, and, oh, Haku's a dragon, I kind of want to fuck, but...
Wait, what?
Everyone wanted to fuck the dragon. Everyone on the internet wants to fuck the dragon.
This explains some websites I saw a few years ago that I didn't understand.
I really hate to say it. It's sort of like, it's that weird subsect of people that, like, no one likes acknowledging in any fandom, because every fandom has a horny subsect and no one likes acknowledging them. That's the one that no one likes acknowledging in, like, Ghibli fandom, because Ghibli is like, oh, it's, you know, family friendly, and there's a lot of horny fuckers in Ghibli fandom. But we ignore all of the parts where, like, Miyazaki is yelling, like, your lifestyle is wrong and I hate you. Rumiko Takahashi, who is a famous mangaka, does the exact same thing in series like Rene and Inuyasha. Look at a lot of, like, the manga and anime of, like, the 2000s to see that there was a lot of anti-Western sentiment in it. And, you know, especially that generation, you know, Rumiko Takahashi, child of people that, you know, survived Nagasaki and Hiroshima. You can't, Miyazaki of that generation as well. Like, you cannot look at some of these directors and not be like, hi, I wonder why you have complicated feelings about the US, or why you have some directors that are super, super into American culture, but it's very, like, cherry-picked parts of American culture, like Shinichiro Watanabe, who loves aspects of Western culture, and you can see that, but then as a whole is very, very critical of some of the other aspects of it. So take a look at some Japanese media, but very, very critically. One thing I hate about anime fans, especially newer ones, this is where I become a gatekeep girl boss gaslight, is a lack of critical thinking. It's, oh my God, I watched an anime and it's the best thing ever. And, like, thinking about it without the cultural context of what it means. That this is not media that was made for an American audience. It's media made for a different audience. And what that means to you and for your consumption. I think that's true about any kind of media, especially if it's coming from somewhere else. Also that it's a form of, like, modern soft politics that, you know, Japan is trying to re-ingratiate itself with all of its pop culture. And it works. Because we don't think about, like, the rape of Nanking. We think about Hello Kitty. We don't think about, like, the human rights violations that happened during World War II. We think about, like, you know, oh, fun, you know, trip to Japan. Oh, look at the deer. Look at the deer in Nara. But no one's talking about, like, what Emperor Hirohito was doing during World War II.
Is it bad that my brain is, like, immediately goes, suicide forest?
Do not go to the suicide forest. Please do not go to the suicide forest.
I have no desire.
I sound new agey, but I pick up that energy when I go to those places, and it wrecks me. So
yeah, it's hard. But yeah, so go watch some media that is tactfully critical of what the U.S. did. I say tactfully because some people will like to ride this wave of indignation that are not necessarily a part of this. And it's very, very frustrating. One bad faith criticism that I'll see a lot is when other Western cultures will condemn the U.S.'s decision as if they would have done anything differently. Like, I will not accept this from, like, people in the U.K. I will not accept this from Germans. I will not accept this from any other, like, Western European power who's like, you guys could have done something else. What were you doing?
Dying?
Well, yes. My most indignant time in Japan was I was waiting for the bullet train and I saw this white guy. And, you know, he's like in a fedora because of course he is. And he's just like bopping along. He is a white guy in like one of those like Hawaiian shirts that I think had like blue flames on it or something. He was like every stereotypical anime con white guy. And we like lock eyes. And he's like, and I'm like, where are you from? He's like, I'm from Germany. He's like, where are you from? Like, I'm from Texas. And he's like, oh, Texas. And he has finger guns. He's like, bang, bang, Texas, pew, pew. And it's like, I will not accept that from a German. I will be condescended to by any other nation. I will not be condescended to by a German. That was my indignant part. Anyone else could have done that. And I would have been like, you know what? You've earned that. You... sir, no, I do not accept that from you.
I wish it was socially acceptable for me to carry around a water bottle and just go, shh, shh, no, like you do with a cat.
Stop it. Like, you of all people say that. But I've had a great time talking about this very, very sad book for children. Did we have to read this when we were in school?
I did, but we focused more on Hiroshima, like hardcore in our humanities class, so.
We focused a lot more on like folding actual cranes. I guess like that was just like the Catholic school part where it's just like, let's focus on the art part. Do you want to fold some cranes, children? Do you want? Yeah, it was in that like giant book of sad things.
The Glencoe.
Yeah, it was in this giant tome of sad literature things. So I did read this when I was younger. I think where I question why we make kids read this so young is that, again, it's that historical context. And I don't think that, well, I mean, I don't think that America on a whole is good at talking about this age in our history. But especially like, I definitely don't in hindsight trust how my Texan teachers were covering this period of history.
I will say I am super hopeful. I was having a conversation with my daughter today and she said, I'm actually really enjoying my history class. And I'm like, okay, tell me about your history class. She goes, well, normally I find it boring because people don't teach it well, but my teacher teaches it really well. And we were talking about Columbus and he actually wasn't afraid about talking about the controversy. And he asked us how many people thought, you know, Columbus was a good guy or how many people thought he was more like a villain. And she goes, and like the majority of their class raised their hand on villain. And
good job.
I go, that is so cool because when I was in kindergarten, we celebrated him like a hero. I mean, it wasn't until I was out of college reading about the stuff that happened and going, my God, what the fuck? Like, this guy is one of our heroes. And like, it's something now that, and history changes over time.
It does.
We find out new things. We find out pieces that were hidden. I mean, like right now there's this huge push in like Greece and other places finding, you know, older temples, finding pieces of things that have been missing for a very long time. There are now satellite programs that are finding missing temples in South America, things that people haven't set eyes on for thousands of years. More like hundreds, let's be real. But just that
every day we find out something new. We find out a new aspect of culture. We find out, you know, one thing that we always thought we didn't understand how point A led to point B. Now we know that there was something between that. Like it's right. something that if you are willing to constantly be learning and constantly adapting your mindset, you'll do great. And that's
I think that's the big thing is if you're willing. There has never been more available as far as resources and history and the ability to access stories than ever. But you have to be willing to find it. You have to be willing to listen, and you have to be willing to be open to receive it.
And that's where there's a lot of difficulty, is especially if you are completely convinced that everything you believe is perfect and wonderful and you never have your mind changed. That is a really dangerous way of thinking. And unfortunately, like, I've seen this sticker and it cracks me up. I'm sorry for the things I said to you when I was an evangelical Christian. because when you're very, very little, and this isn't to go off on a tangent, but when you're very, very little and there are certain things you believe that's what your parents tell you, that's what their parents told them, and their parents, and it goes back and back and back. And you don't, a lot of times, you don't examine that until you're a little bit older. But when you examine it, you start to be like, well, why do I believe this? You know, and then when you start to take it apart, you realize there are certain aspects that are super positive for the community, certain definitely positive for your life structure. But sometimes there are destructive portions of that that need to be weeded out and removed. And it's just there because it's tradition. It's an easier pathway in your brain from having to form a new one. And that's a lot of times why we have these snap judgments and things like that. It's a way that we developed as human beings to survive and look at something and be like, that's a tiger, that's dangerous, I got to get out of here. Our brains are fully capable of taking in more information and transforming that thought pattern, but you have to be willing.
Yeah, absolutely. You can find us all over the social internet where I'm doing my best. And Tori's been knocking it out of the park.
I was like, you just get weird Facebook memes because they make me laugh really hard. And I need other people to laugh at literature jokes because otherwise I'm the only one in my house unless I text them to Amanda.
No, Tori's doing great. I have been going through it.
And so honestly, Twitter is a cesspool. So it didn't use... Well, it's always been a part cesspool. No, it's like always a nice been. Deck over it.
Yeah, it's a... Oof. Yep. That's an issue. But we are doing our best all over the social internet. Tori, would you like to tell the good people where they can find us?
So we are on Unfortunately Required Reading on Facebook, Unfortunately RR on Twitter, Unfortunately Required on Instagram, or just one place for everything, unfortunatelyrequiredreading.com. We are also have an email address, which we, believe it or not, do occasionally check. Unfortunately required reading@gmail.com. And do you want to tell them what our book is going to be?
Sure. We are covering A Brave New World by Adolphus Huxley.
I am so excited about this. And you guys are going to be like so mad at me because I've been reading way too much on Aldous Huxley lately. So
I'm mildly excited for it. This is a part of the show where we thank our patrons. Thank you so much for keeping the lights on metaphorically and physically. If you would like to join them, you may do so at whatever Spotify changed our URL to. whatever the fuck Spotify changed our URL to. I think it's like podcasters.spotify. Whatever. It's too long. It's too long now. Or you can look for our merch on Redbubble.
Yes. And some of it's pretty good.
Some of it's pretty good. Thank you all for listening. This episode has been, I think it's necessary, you know, especially after the whole Barbenheimer thing and during August, where we do honor the losses that happened during Hiroshima and Nagasaki. I think it was important to talk about this. A book that I feel like a lot of Americans read, but probably didn't really absorb. Because you're just too young. You can't.
you're a kid. I mean, it's hard to internalize it.
Right. Like, I mean, we're whole ass adults in our 30s, and we're like, we don't know what to do about the legacy of atomic weaponry. Yet alone, it's like, here's a junior high kid. Like, go figure it out. So, thank you guys for listening. We will see you in the next one. Be safe out there and go read a book. Bye.